Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Leeward Islands Squadron by Chris Durbin, narrated by Stephen Crossley. The 7 Years' War, 1756, Disaster on Land and Sea. The 7 Years' War, known in America as the French and Indian War, can justly be described as the first global conflict. It was fought in Europe, North America, the West and East Indies, Africa, and all the oceans of the world. By its end, Britain was the undisputed master of North America and India, and most importantly, of the trade routes between the home islands and her colonies. The war marked the start of Britannia's 163 years of ruling the waves, from the Annus Mirabilis of 1759 to the Washington Naval Treaty of 1922. However, the first year of the war, 1756, didn't end well for Britain. Minorca had been lost to the French through naval mismanagement. Calcutta had been besieged and taken by the Nawab of Bengal, and Montcalm had captured Fort Oswego on Lake Ontario for the French. The first Newcastle administration had fallen, and the government was rocked by the trial of Admiral Byng. But through this gloom, Lord Anson, the first Lord of the Admiralty before he was temporarily cast into the wilderness along with the Duke of Newcastle, had started to deploy his ships to counterattack. This is the fictitious story of Captain Edward Carlyle and his first Lieutenant George Holbrooke, as they form the tip of the spear that Anson thrust into the French West Indian possessions. If any of Carlyle or Holbrooke's exploits, either ashore or afloat, seem a little unlikely, then I recommend that you read Augustus Hervey's journal, which was published in 2002 by Chatham Publishing. Hervey spent much of the 7 Years' War at sea in command, and was present at several battles and other operations, including the disastrous Battle of Minorca. When you read his startlingly frank account of those times, you will agree that a novelist has no need of overstatement when writing of the Royal Navy of the mid-18th century. The Captain. Lastly, whereas the charge and command of the ship and of the officers and men serving therein are entirely entrusted to the captain, and the welfare and good management of the whole does in a special manner depend upon his economy and prudence, he is to understand. He is himself responsible for the whole conduct and good government of the ship, and for the due execution of all regulations here set down, which concern the several duties of the officers and company of the ship who are to obey him in all things which he shall direct them for his Majesty's service. Regulations and Instructions, 1734. Principal Characters. Fictional Characters. Captain Robert Jermy, Commanding Officer, Wessex, and Commodore of the Squadron. Captain Edward Carlyle, Commanding Officer, Medina. Lieutenant Miles Godwin, 1st Lieutenant, Wessex. Lieutenant George Holbrooke, 1st Lieutenant, Medina. James Thompson, Sailing Master, Wessex. John Hosking, Sailing Master, Medina. John Chalmers, Chaplain, Wessex. Able Seaman Jackson, Captain's Coxswain, Medina. Able Seaman Whittle, a follower of Captain Carlyle's from his home in Virginia. Lady Chiara Angelini, Captain Carlyle's friend. Historical Characters. The Duke of Newcastle, Prime Minister of Great Britain from 1754 to 1756 and 1757 to 1762. The Duke of Devonshire, Prime Minister of Great Britain from 1756 to 1757. William Pitt, Leader of the House of Commons from 1756 to 1761. Lord George Anson, First Lord of the Admiralty from 1751 to 1756 and 1757 to 1762. Rear Admiral Thomas Frankland, Commander-in-Chief, Leeward Islands Station. Prologue. Privateers. Monday, 15th of November, 1756. Medina, at sea, Ushant, east-southeast, 17 leagues. There were no lights showing in Medina. Even the tiny binnacle lantern had been extinguished, and the slow match at the guns had been covered with tarpaulins to prevent the privateers detecting her presence. The frigate ghosted along under her lower sails alone, the light northwesterly breeze providing enough steerage way to keep her head to the southwest as she kept pace with the convoy a mile to windward. The swell building from the west suggested that these light airs would not last the night, but it was the next few hours that concerned Captain Carlyle.
"Deck ho! I see 'em, sir! Broad on the larboard beam!"
Even the lookout was speaking softly, as much as a man can do when calling to the quarter-deck from the masthead.
"Both of them? Where are they heading?"
"Same course as us, sir. Two brigs under full sail, about 2 miles away."
"Very well, Whittle. Let me know if they alter course, but keep a sharp lookout all round."
Carlyle breathed a sigh of relief. He had staked his reputation on the two French brig corvettes using their superior speed to cross the convoy's wake as soon as the light faded. His conference with the convoy commander had been unsatisfactory, shouted across 50 yards of heaving sea. Carlyle had pressed his opinion as hard as he could. His conviction that the attack would come from leeward, not from windward, where the enemy was first sighted. Captain Jeremy was a sick man, which may have accounted for his lack of tactical thought. It was evident to Carlyle that the French privateers would want a clear run back to France if they should be fortunate enough to cut out one of the Levanters, the Turkey merchants, as they were sometimes called, or even an East Indiaman. Backing her captain's hunch, and in defiance of orders, Medina had reduced sail and slipped quietly through the convoy as soon as Carlyle was confident that the brigs could no longer distinguish him from the ships of the convoy.
"Mr. Holbrook," he said to his first lieutenant, "let the men know the situation. It's probably best if you walk down to the guns and tell them individually. We can expect no immediate help from Wessex, not until we start firing."
The Commodore's ship had remained resolutely to windward of the convoy where the privateers were last seen.
"Aye, aye, sir," replied Holbrook. He lowered his voice.
"It looks like we are in the right position after all."
This was the closest that Holbrook could come to open criticism of the captain of Wessex, 4 years senior to Carlyle on the captain's list, and commodore of this small squadron by courtesy of those few years. Carlyle took a few turns up and down the quarter-deck. In his last commission, he would have been staring eagerly to leeward, hoping for a glimpse of the brigs. Since then he had learned to trust his lookouts, who surely had better eyes than he had and could be relied upon to report any change. He needed this time to decide on his next move, and he knew that he had two options. The obvious and safe course of action was to disrupt the attack immediately by opening fire, long range though it was, and bringing Wessex hurrying through the convoy to help. That would at least hold off the brigs while they decided on their next move, and may even cause the privateer masters to give up. After all, the wind was set to increase, and the convoy would consequently move much faster on its way across the Bay of Biscay, making attacks more difficult. However, Carlyle had an embryonic reputation as a fighting captain, a reputation won in the desperate fight to take Vulcain earlier that year in the Mediterranean. And if it were to persist, that reputation had to be fed and nurtured. Apparently his frigate had not yet been identified by the two brigs,
Medina having reduced sail specifically to blend in with the three East Indiamen who habitually shortened sail overnight. The four Levanters were forced to copy the Indiamen or lose the protection of the convoy and their insurance. The bold option was to wait until the brigs were committed to the attack and then spring the trap. He could damage them, perhaps even take one, but a determined French attacker had at least a chance of carrying off a prize in a confused nighttime melee. Carlyle turned over the alternatives in his mind, but the deciding factor was the cohesion of his crew. When he commissioned Medina only last month, he had been permitted to turn over most of his people from his previous command, Fury. His complement had been made up with a draft from the press tender, competent seamen for the most part, but there was still a clear split between the old Furies and the new men. Carlyle hoped that the first taste of action would bring them together, and it was that thought that tipped the balance.
"Mr. Asking," he said to the sailing master, "bring her on to the wind. We will move closer to the convoy."
He was committed. Now, when he opened fire, the brigs would be too close for Wessex to intervene in time. He was consciously cutting his superior officer out of the action, or that is how it would look in a court-martial. Carlyle had sent the crew to quarters at dusk, but the frigate had been cleared for action long before then. They were all at their stations now, not stripped to the waist as they had generally been in the Mediterranean, but still wearing shirts, waistcoats and jackets against the North Atlantic in November. It could be a long wait before the Frenchmen made their move. Holbrook returned silently to the quarterdeck.
"The men are in good heart, sir. Looking forward to a little action."
He looked over the larboard quarter to where the lookout had reported the privateers.
"I fancy I can just see them now, a pale patch against the darkness."
It was a dark night. The moon and stars were hidden by a blanket of low cloud that almost met the sea, and the light wind was doing nothing to disperse it. The dew had already started to fall, dampening the miles of hemp cordage and causing the boatswain and his mates to scurry from fore to aft, feeling the tension on the shrouds. Carlyle gave a sideways glance to leeward. He didn't know why, but it was much easier to detect objects in the dark that way. Holbrook was correct. The two brigs were just visible from the deck. They had all sail set and were beating up towards the convoy in a most determined manner.
"At least you won't have to worry about Fury's old demi-battery this time, Mr. Holbrook," said Carlyle. "Your 28 guns are all under your own eye now."
Holbrook smiled. Medina was of a newer generation than Fury. In fact, she had only completed fitting out last month. Medina had four more 9-pounders than the older frigate, but the critical point was that they were all on the upper deck in two long batteries, and only the 4 3-pounders were on the quarter-deck. There were no guns at all on the forecastle, and none on the lower deck. It gave the first lieutenant a far greater degree of control over the ship's main armament.
"They are moving up fast now, sir," observed Holbrook. "They certainly have a good turn of speed, about a point free of the wind, I should say."
"Wonderfully fast, those brig corvettes. But then they don't have to carry 3 months' stores and water, and their scantlings don't have to stand the rigours of years on blockade duty. Out and back in less than a week is their normal routine."
"I'll let them come closer before we spring the trap," replied Carlyle. Medina was close astern of the last Levanter, with the Indiamen clustered at the head of the convoy. The brigs were now a mile to the east of the frigate. In this meagre visibility, it was unlikely that the masters of the convoyed ships would have seen the threat approaching from leeward. Carlyle watched intently, waiting for the moment when he judged that the brigs would perceive the trap that had been set for them.
"There they go," said the master,
as the two brigs put up their helms and started to come off the wind, They had spotted the frigate lying in wait for them.
"Stand by larboard battery!" roared Holbrook.
"Put up your helm, Mr. Hosking!" shouted Carlyle. "Mr. Holbrook, fire when your gun's bare!"
Medina turned smoothly to larboard. When the lead privateer was squarely on her beam, Holbrook gave the order, and the battery opened with a roar, all guns erupting nearly simultaneously to send 114 pounds of cast iron across the 8 cables of water that now separated them. It was difficult to see any damage. The telescope was useless in this light, and the new night glasses that Carlyle had heard about had not yet made its way to sea. However, it looked like the lead privateer was struggling with her 4 topsails, so perhaps they had scored some hits. Carlyle recognized this as the moment of greatest danger. He could see that after a few minutes' hesitation, the sternmost Indiaman had hardened onto the wind in an instinctive desire to put the greatest possible distance between them and their attackers, and the others were in the act of following suit. Wessex would have heard the thunder of Medina's guns and would have seen the flash on this dark night. She would surely come down to assist. But in the meantime the brigs could split up and attack the head and tail of the convoy. If they did that, there was at least an even chance that they could snap up a valuable prize in the confusion and darkness. Carlyle knew that he had to keep the French privateers on the back foot.
"Mr. Hosking, lay a course to intercept the 2nd brig. I expect her to attack the rear of the convoy. Mr. Holbrook, have you reloaded?"
"Yes, sir. Loaded with ball." "Deck there. I can see the Commodore coming down now. It looks like he will pass ahead of the convoy."
Good. At least Jeremy was thinking. If Medina was engaged astern, as the flashes from her broadside would suggest, then Wessex should be at the head of the convoy. As if on cue, the lead brig altered course to larboard and headed southwest.
"Mr. Holbrook, 1 broadside for our friend as we pass. Aim for her masts."
A staggered broadside this time, carefully aimed by each gun captain. Now that the brig was nearer, holes could be seen in her sails, and there were a few parted lines hanging slack in the light breeze, but no critical damage. She sped on southwest, unaware that Wessex was heading for the same point. Carlyle carefully observed the 2 brigs. Their intention was clear. One would attack the head of the convoy while the other would attack the rear. Medina couldn't deal with both attacks, and one of them would surely make off with a prize. A large, well-practiced and ruthless prize crew could board and be underway to France in 10 minutes. That would leave one of the brigs to continue to harry the convoy, preventing the escort from chasing the retreating prize. The whole plan relied on Wessex being unable to interfere in time to shift the balance. They didn't yet know how close Wessex was to the head of the convoy. Carlyle felt confident that between them, the 50-gun fourth-rate and the 28-gun frigate, they could hold off the 2 privateers.
"Deck ho! Wessex has veered! She's bows on to us!"
Carlyle couldn't believe his ears, but a glance to windward showed him the truth of the lookout's hail.
"Put the ship about, Mr. Hosking!"
Carlyle pounded the quarter-deck rail with his fist. How could Jeremy be so foolish? His action meant that the 1st brig would be free to take his pick of the convoy, while the 2nd, the decoy, led them further astern.
"Mr. Holbrook, a broadside from the larboard guns as they bear."
In an instant, the situation had changed. The 1st brig, the one that displayed Medina's shot holes in her sails, was far ahead and evidently preparing to lay alongside the leading Indiaman. A sudden flash and eruption of smoke, followed quickly by the sharp report of the brig's broadside, showed that she was close enough to her prey for even her light guns to come into play, 6 pounders at best, but more likely 3 or 4 pounders. The Indiaman, she looked like the Beaufort, an old and small ship for the John Company, seemed too panicked to realize that her best defense was to veer and run down to Medina. She appeared overly concerned with boarding nets and bringing her own battery into action. By sheer weight of broadside, she should be able to hold her own. After all, she had 32 guns, which in the Navy would put her in the fifth rate, one above Medina. But her crew was pitifully small, and she would barely have 100 men to serve them and to manage the sails. Far too few and utterly insufficient to repel a French privateer's boarding party. The drama unfolded in front of the group gathered on Medina's quarterdeck. To their horror, they saw the brig crash alongside the Indiaman. A horde of Frenchmen, hardly slowed by the boarding nets, poured onto her decks. They watched helplessly as her halyard was slashed and her ensign fell over the stern to trail behind. A splash of red in her grey and white wake, easily visible in the light from the lanterns that had just sprung to life in her stern windows. Did the Frenchman know that Medina had changed course? Probably not, thought Carlyle. She was well enough handled, but she was no king's ship, and would lack the discipline that kept Whittle at Medina's masthead looking all around the horizon. With his countrymen at the masthead, Carlyle could concentrate on the battle, leaving the wider surveillance in good hands.
"Mr. Holbrook, Mr. Hosking, I would rather not be fighting 300 French privateers on the deck of the Indiaman. It's not worth the casualties that we would take. So, we'll advertise our presence and threaten to trap her between Medina and her prize. A broadside now, Mr. Holbrook, to leeward. I don't want to harm the Beaufort. Mr. Hosking, steer a course to bring me alongside the brig, but I trust that she will see sense and sheer off before we arrive."
Carlyle knew very well that his actions could easily be misconstrued as cowardice, and he saw that same understanding in the master's face as he turned away to give his orders. The master didn't yet know him. Medina's larboard battery fired, the shot landing harmlessly a mile or so towards Ushant.
"That got their attention," said Carlyle to the quarterdeck in general. "Now, let's see what they do. Mr. Holbrook, stand by to board her over our starboard side, in case they're a bloody-minded crew and don't care to withdraw. Jackson, muster your boarders on the forecastle,"
shouted Holbrook to the captain's coxswain, the leader of the boarders for the larboard watch.
"Aye, sir,"
replied Jackson. There was a close understanding between these two men, forged in combat in the Mediterranean. It was Jackson who steered the boat into St. Stephen's Cove in Minorca under the guns of de Richelieu's siege batteries. It was Jackson who had crowded alongside Holbrook when he boarded Vulcain from their little barque Longa and turned the tide of the battle, slashing wildly with his cutlass to protect the lieutenant's unguarded left side. And it was Jackson again who dragged the three-pounder into position on St. Honorat Island and stood exposed in the bright sunshine waiting for the supposed corsair to negotiate a truce. Yes, Holbrook would be pleased to have Jackson seconding him if they had to settle this business on the deck of the French privateer. The privateer did indeed see sense. The scene was almost comical as the French boarders hurriedly, very hurriedly, retraced their movements, the final dozen having to jump for their lives and liberty across the widening chasm as the brig sheered away and put her stern to the wind. The very last man paused indecisively on the gunwale, terrified of the widening gap and the grey sea rushing below him. He glanced behind and gathered himself to make the leap, but too late. A Lascar, a native seaman of the East Indies, swung at him with a boarding axe that bit deep into his shoulder, and he tumbled forward to be lost in the tumbling wake.
"Mr. Hosking, put up your helm and bring us across her stern,"
he said, pointing to the fleeing privateer.
"We'll give her a raking broadside to remember us by. Is your larboard battery ready, Mr. Holbrook?"
"Ready, aye, ready,"
replied Holbrook, wiping the powder stains from his face. Slowly, Medina drew across the brig's stern, and slowly
too slowly, the brig moved away to the southeast. The range was only 2 cables, point blank for 9-pounders, when Holbrook gave the command.
Fire!
There were experienced men among the gun crews, men from the old Fury who had 3 times engaged the heavy frigate Vulcan and 3 times raked her from stern to stem. It was hardly credible, but to Carlyle it looked as though every shot had found its mark. The windows and planking of her stern just ceased to exist, and the whole run of her upper deck was revealed, a tangle of overturned guns and mangled flesh. Yet somehow her 2 masts were still standing, and her sails were still drawing as she slowly and painfully sailed out of range and was swallowed into the blackness.
"There's no more fight left in her, gentlemen. We can leave her to make her way home."
Carlyle glanced over to the Beaufort. She looked intact, and a reassuring wave from her master left little doubt as to his next action.
"Mr. Hosking, haul your wind and place us astern of the convoy. We'll leave Wessex to deal with her privateer. I don't expect we'll see any more of ours today."
The sailing master gave him a curious look. It was a look of surprise and recognition. A sideways glance and slight tilt of the head in acknowledgement of a job well done. Carlyle realized that he had been under suspicion by this older man. He had been suspected of cowardice when he declined to lay himself alongside the privateer and fight it out toe to toe. But Hosking was an old campaigner and could see that Carlyle had been correct. A dangerous attack had been repulsed without any casualties. It may not make the broadsheets in London, but it was a thoroughly professional piece of work. 1. The Commodore. Tuesday, 16th of November, 1756. Medina, at sea, Ushant, northeast, 50 leagues. The foretold wind arrived in the morning watch, a moderate westerly with a little south in it that swept away the gloom and the low clouds and wafted the convoy on its voyage south by west at a respectable 6 knots, close-hauled on the starboard tack. However, the rising sun revealed a convoy visibly shaken by the night's activity. The 3 Indiamen and the 4 Levanters clung tightly to each other and showed no tendency to stray far from the protection of their escorts. Beaufort still had stray lines and ripped sails, but she was holding her place in the convoy, her decks and rigging crawling with men engaged in the skilled work of repairing timber, canvas, and cordage.
"Will the Commodore call for you, sir?" asked the master.
Carlyle had been considering just that question when his thoughts had been interrupted. There was no doubt that his actions could be regarded as insubordinate on the one hand and lacking conduct, even cowardly, on the other. He knew that his tactics had been correct. He was right to persuade the Commodore to split his forces. It had been hard waiting until the privateers were committed before revealing his presence, but again it was the best thing to do. His greatest professional gamble was probably warning off the first brig rather than engaging in hand-to-hand fighting on the deck of an Indiaman. But, without a doubt, he had prevented unnecessary casualties among his crew while still achieving his objective. He also knew that Jeremy was wrong to ignore the first brig and steer for the tail of the convoy. If Medina hadn't reversed course at the critical moment, it was quite likely that Beaufort would now be a prize under a French battery somewhere on the Brittany coast. But these were difficult concepts to articulate, because they were founded on the proposition that his lawfully appointed superior was incompetent. Any of his actions, correct though they were, could be turned against him in an inquiry, or, God forbid, a court-martial. Carlyle crossed his fingers behind his back, a personal superstition that age and responsibility had failed to eradicate. So, taken all in all, he would rather not have to justify himself to Jeremy. If the Commodore felt any irritation after the actions of the night, Then Carlyle would just have to hope that he would have forgotten it before the Indiamen parted company north of Madeira.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?